Okay, thank you very much, Kai, and thank you very much to everybody for your patience. And so I will talk today about a problem which is very related to the problem of Eugenio. Actually, it's the same problem, how to create avalanche, how to design avalanche models that has aftershocks in order to justify the statistical properties of earthquakes. And but this with the approach is different in the sense that I'm in this class of people that work on self-organized criticality and more precisely on the model of the depinning transition. And so I have to acknowledge my two collaborators. One is Eduardo Jagra, who actually introduced this idea of modifying this model of the depinning transition in order to observe aftershock. And one of the first papers was with Alejandro. I don't know if he's here. Yes, he's there. And then here we introduce a model which is quite simple, or simple enough to be studied very well with numerics and also with a little of analytics. And the guy, which is very important for this work, is François Lang, who did the PhD with me, just finished, and now is in Trieste with Marcus. So maybe I will go a little bit faster on this first slide. So the idea is that there are a lot of systems in nature which displays avalanche statistics. And one of the first, which is very famous, is the Barkhausen noise that is observed when you increase the external magnetic field of a ferromagnet. And then what you observe is that the magnetization does not increase continuously with the field, but it displays period when nothing happens and jumps where the magnetization increase of a large amount. And so the noise is this colored noise that you can observe when you increase the magnetic field in this ferromagnet. And this is one of the system where these models of avalanches that I will just discuss in a second apply. Okay. And so to be very concrete, let me define a model. So the idea is that we want to reproduce the dynamics of a fault. And so it's a two-dimensional system in a first approximation. And we can say that this system is driven continuously because of the motion of the tectonic plates. And this drive is very slow, is few centimeters per year. But the system is a system with many degrees of freedom and is able to absorb this stress. It does not move immediately, but it releases this stress in amounts which are random in time and in size. Okay? And so this model represents the fault as a collection of blocks. Here is the one-dimensional version. And each block has a certain amount of stress, for example, it's here. And because of the drive, all blocks increase slowly the stress, and they don't move because of the heterogeneities, the asperities in the medium. And then there is a threshold, which is quite realistic to suppose that it's random because there are heterogeneities in the medium. And once one block reach its own instability threshold, then it moves. This is the first thing that happens, and because it moves, it lose its stress. So this side, this block, lose its own stress. And now we have two things that happen. Because it moves, it change the medium around him. So we have a new threshold of instability, which is drawn, which is different from the previous one. And also there is a stress redistribution, which is very fast, which occur on the order of the magnitude of 1 second. And so it transmits part of the stress he has lost to the neighbors. And so this can trigger a new event, which is not triggered by the driving, but is triggered directly by this instability. And so this new block become unstable, and the process go on like a domino effect. And so we have what is called an avalanche.
So you have two things. One is the stress redistribution, and the other is changing the threshold after a little.
Yes. Okay, this model is, we will see in 1 second, is really the model of the depinning transition. Okay, so there are a few ingredients. There is the stress redistribution and the fact that the threshold are random. And I define the size of the avalanche is just the number of sides which are unstable. And if you want the time, the duration of the avalanches is the number of steps that you have. So here the duration is 4 and the size is 5.
I didn't understand the comment about the threshold change.
Yeah?
So I guess because you didn't write down the model of threshold and I don't remember. So how does it change and why does it change?
So it changed because the block moves. So here the blocks are in a given position. So they feel some disorder, okay? Then they overcome the metastable state where they are, and they move physically, and they go in a new metastable state, which is a new threshold, which will be characterized by the different threshold.
But it's just a pinning. I should just think of it as a pinning potential.
Yes, I will show this in a second.
So it's no more than that. It's not like pinning potential.
Okay, got it. Okay. So I misunderstood.
So it's still a pinning potential, and that's just given sample.
Yes. Yes, but
it's just in a different configuration.
Think of, say, tectonic plane like this, and it moves, and then the disorder is different from the disorder.
Yeah, exactly.
Exactly. Okay, exactly. Okay, so there are fluctuations, spatial fluctuations with the disorder. Okay, but in the next two slides, maybe it will be more clear.
I mean, there are also, you know, people distinguish between, and maybe here it's not important because you're not, you know, there's a static friction and there's a kinetic friction.
Yeah, I will arrive. Okay. So this is a model, okay, it's defined like this. And so this is an example, and you can actually change many ingredients. You can say, for example, that the thresholds are not updated. You can change the ingredients. All these models produce avalanches with a statistic which is in general different. And all these models have three ingredients which are important for avalanches. The first one is that the system is out of equilibrium because you drive the system, so you inject energy, and it's dissipated via avalanches. This thing is also important. You have randomness, so you need some source of random. It can be in the threshold, it can be in the initial condition. And then the system is also strongly interacting. You have this redistribution of stress, which is important in order to give an avalanche, okay, to communicate with your neighbors. When you have these three ingredients, what you usually observe is a power law distribution in the size of the avalanche. So you have a free scale statistics, as if you have a critical phase transition, which is characterized by an exponent tau, which is universal. It does not depend on the distribution of the threshold. It does not depend on the lattice that you decide if it's square or hexagonal. It depends on the dimensionality, on the range of the interactions, and on the correlation of the disorder. And as it was noticed yesterday, there are, at small scale, some behavior which is just microscopic and is non-universal. And at large scales, there is a cutoff in general, which is controlled by the fact that we have dissipation. The smaller it is the dissipation, the more you see field scale statistics. The larger it is the dissipation, the more this cutoff is small, so you cut your universal scaling.
You have a more specific connection in mind between this model and earthquake faults. Are you thinking of, I'm visualizing that maybe what you're thinking of is a network
of springs, yes.
Small faults. And,
yes. So my point of view was, now I introduce a generic model of what are the generic ingredients of avalanche. And so in the next slide, I will introduce a model where you will see the fault and everything. So let me give the problem, okay? So the problem is that this class of models, you can be the pinning, direct percolation, things, they have some feature. One is this power law statistics that we like because we want to reproduce the Gutenberg-Richter law, okay? But if you look at the value of the exponent, experimentally, I mean, from the earthquake, you find that the exponent is 1.7, okay? So this is the Gutenberg-Richter exponent. And all these models with these ingredients, they have exponents that are at most 1.5. 1.5 is the mean field exponent. And then when you lower the dimension, the tau decrease. So you cannot justify 1.7 using this self-organized criticality models. And then the other point, which was raised also by Eugenio, is that the shocks, the avalanches, are strongly correlated. And this is something that, if you look at this figure, is missing in the model. So this is the figure that Eugenio showed on Monday. is California, you look at the magnitude of the earthquakes as a function of time, and you see that when you have an important earthquake, then you have a lot of suns and a lot of offsprings. And when you look at the evolution of the model that I just defined, then you see that the correlation maybe are there. This is for two dimension, but for sure they are very small. Okay, they cannot explain. So is the magnitude of the size of the earthquake as a function of time for this organized criticality model.
So time here is essentially increasing the gravity.
Exactly. So the you have a velocity of the gravity and this gives you the time. Okay. So after a big earthquake, there is nothing that happens in this model. Okay. There is no memory. So here is the slide that maybe you want to. So we have to give a kind of model of our fault. Okay. And so the idea of the model that I just presented is a model for a solid which is elastic and is driven over a landscape which is random. So here these are the randomness, which are different one from the other, okay? And if you look at your block here, there are three interactions that act on him. There is this pink interaction, which is the drive, which is described by this term, okay? So W is the position where the block should be if there was no disorder, and which evolves in time very slowly. And this is the force acting on the block because of this driving. And then you have the elastic force, which is in green, okay, are these springs, which are describes the interactions with the neighbors. So the picture should be two-dimensional. Here is just a one-dimensional. And so this is given by this term. And then you have the disorder that mimic the effect of the friction, if you want. The block cannot move, stay in this well, okay? And when a threshold is overcome, then the block jump on the next well, okay? So this model is similar. Yes, H of I and also I here, okay? So the thing I want to, so this model is the depending model, okay, is the model of the depending transition, and is very well studied as property that we know very well, like the passing rule and so on. But there are many ways to implement this equation. You can solve the equation in a continuum version. Here I will introduce an automata version, which corresponds to consider these wells as narrow wells. So when you increase the position of your drive a little bit, the stress on each block increases. So you have to move. Okay? But if the well is very narrow, the adjustment that you have inside the well is very little. So the movement on H is very small and can be neglected. Up to the time where you reach a given threshold and you come out of this well and you go on the next well, which has a distance z, which is a random variable distributed with the distribution g of z. And so because of these discrete jumps, you can consider, you can actually update discrete rules to study the evolution of this equation. Okay? So let me show that the rules are exactly the same I gave you at the beginning. So this is the force which acts on the block. It's the sum of these two terms, the driving and the elastic interaction, is what I call sigma hi. Then when you are unstable and you make your jump on the next well, then you see that the position hi increase of z, and so you lose stress 2 times kz because of the elasticity, and k0z because of the driving. So you have reached your threshold and the stress goes down of this quantity. And now because of these 2 points, hi plus one, hi minus one, the two neighbors receive a stress which is kz. So because of this constant k0, you have a dissipation of the stress, which is k0z, and the other part of the stress is redistributed to the two neighbors, okay? So this model is exactly the same of what I said before. It's just the continuum version of the cellular automata that I defined before. OK? Okay.
Can I ask, in terms of loading, I thought, so eyes, you think a one-dimensional model or two-dimensional? Or?
No, at the end the simulation will be two-dimensional, so I will have an interface that moves like this.
Right, so then this loading, the first term is, for earthquakes it would be like a one face of the...
One plane.
It's just on one plane, that's a top
mm-hmm.
plane.
Mm-hmm.
So it doesn't couple to all HIs, it just couples to the HIs
on the
top surface.
It's on
the fault.
It's
on the fault.
You're assuming that the variance perpendicular to the plane
yes.
in this example.
Say again?
This example, in this model, you are assuming that the variance perpendicular to the fault plane.
Oh, I see.
Okay. Not like this, because otherwise it will be periodic system. This is what you mean.
Right. Okay.
It will be different. It will be similar, but a different universality class. Okay?
And eventually then go to long-range interactions, or just...
Well, that's what I'm...
Okay, so in principle, there are evidence that the interactions are long-ranged. I will do at the end the Milfield model, so it will be very long range, but at the beginning I will study the short range case. Okay?
Is your substrate surface running in a vertical or horizontal direction in this picture?
Vertical.
Vertical.
So here is one dimension, okay? So it's an interface.
Yeah.
It moves like this. So, like this.
So it's just the front.
Yes, it's an interface that moves
But it's not, maybe it's the same universality or something, but it's not. I picture earthquake where you have two blocks, they have a fault in between, and I'm loading a block, top block, that's a far away from the crack.
Mm-hmm.
And I try to drag, you know, the top block across the bottom block.
So there's not a line, but there's a line.
Yeah, it's a different thing.
So I'm just saying, this is a great problem, but at least on the face of it, it's not the same thing as the earthquake problem. Is that correct? Is that true?
Mm-hmm. So what you mean is that you would like...
I just want
to think... You would like to have something like
yeah,
this.
Yeah, like that, and I'm loading it far away, so then there's a long-range strains that are building up.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Because the displacement is much smaller than the typical length scales between the equilibrium length scales of the screen. So
mm-hmm.
You are the total equivalent model. Because you can project on the whole plane, and so the evolution are equivalent. There is no... The adobatoa version are really equivalent to the rules. It's not important if you drive in this direction or in a direction parallel to the whole plane.
Okay, it's not obvious to me, but...
Okay, maybe we can...
No, but the point is that in earthquake planning, you don't have a real defined interface. You can have motion everywhere on the force.
Mm-hmm.
Your point.
Right.
So it's a different... Yeah. I guess it's a different... Geometry.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, there are degrees of freedom away from the interface.
Right.
You know, in this problem. Huh?
Yeah?
Yes, I will change. So, 1 second and I will change the model. So what I'm saying is that this model is like a solid which is driven, if you want, on a rough substrate, okay, like this. Okay. Now, the problem is that it needs the aftershock, so we should put something else, okay? So this is what I'm going to do in the next slide. So the idea is the following. So we...
Plane, no?
Mm-hmm.
Describe this plane only by its ring, no?
No, I mean, the two-dimensional interface is a square lattice where I have these blocks, like a plane that moves like this.
So I is one-dimensional.
Okay.
This is one-dimensional.
Yeah, so that's the order along the ring, no?
So I don't know. So I have done a sketch in one dimension because I'm not able to draw very well in two dimensions, but then I will present the data in two dimensions.
Yeah,
so you have something like this.
This is a drawing from the top.
And yes.
And so here, yeah. So let me see. It's underneath. This is riding on top of random substrate. Like this 2D lattice is riding.
And so I'm driving everything, okay? Mm-hmm. Yes, yes. Yes.
But in the model driving.
Yes, but so what you are saying is that when you break the things, you expect to have the same instability, you have the same quench disorder.
Yeah, but in this model, when you put any like random springs, you don't have this periodicity effect that you're saying. It's already the same.
So if you do think of this as a model for sort of one block sliding on top of another, and if you assume that there is a driving in a certain direction, you would think of a 1D model. But you now have extended it in the other dimension.
Yes.
Where is it driving?
He's driving on every atom simultaneously at the same time.
So,
no, I'm pulling the top
like this. I'm pulling like this.
I think what's confusing is you're talking about it moving this way, but really that's if you think of the displacement along the plane as coming out of the board, which is the way you're thinking about it.
Mm-hmm.
But physically, I think for the rest of it, it's easier to think that there's this elastic medium in two dimensions being pulled along, mm-hmm. right? And in some direction within the plane, and then the analog to the 2+1 dimensional depinning problem is the displacement along the plane is going to be some height effectively coming out of the board, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it's important that this is driven everywhere along the plane at once and not from one end, right? You get very different behavior if...
Yeah, I mean, it's the difference between periodic system and the pinning, this
yeah.
one?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. So here is, I'm driving like this, okay?
But it's also true, it's also different just if you pull from one end, because then the stress has to be distributed.
No, I'm not pulling from one end.
Yeah, so you're
pulling like everything.
If you think about the big plates, this okay. is the fracture you're driving from way out here,
right, exactly.
imposing a strain, and you're looking at the dynamics along this fault, including the elastic coupling within the fault plane, and treating effectively the applied driving field as a sort of mean field.
Okay. No, so here we are doing everybody is pulled at the same way, not only the first part, okay?
But let me just still ask about this picture. So this is a 2D solid, no, on the blackboard.
Mm-hmm.
Where is it in the next instance in time? Is it closer to us or is it across the board?
Closer to us.
It moves out like
yes,
that?
Yes.
Okay. As opposed to
I have to say that the difference between periodic system and standard depinning of the interface is not very crucial for what I'm saying after. So you can do for both model, okay? But my simulation are done for the other one, okay?
So this model is for the depinning transition.
Right, yes. It's a sheet.
So actually, for the people that are not used, there are...
Look at the question evolution of already. A shear system, for a fault system, obviously you have the age are on the fault plane. So around the blackboard, also the edge. But the evolution of the edge, the components along the vertical and the horizontal components follow the same equation. So
no, but the disorder will be different. There will be periodic versus interface.
Not periodic because there is different parts of the interface on.
No, it will be periodic if you're driving this way because...
It's not a crystal. Can we not...
No, you.
No, it doesn't have to be. No, just discreteness. No, from the discreteness of the particles, you will get.
So what the point is the following. But it's not very important because then I will solve the periodic case. But
I think that Dr. Shikawan with his talk may postpone this discussion.
Okay, maybe I will do it. So this is my model, and then I will show that it is not important to have for this discussion. So there are two universality classes with slightly different exponents. Okay, one is the periodic. If I have blocks like this, and the one in the transversal dilation, which is non-periodic. But for the discussion I want to say now is not very important. In any case, here I've done a simulation for the non-periodic case.
Okay. But would you say for the earthquakes, it's the...
Then we will discuss tomorrow, because I think otherwise we will not go on. Okay? So let me explain the new model that we have studied. So this is the traditional deepening model, okay? So you have an interface which moves in this direction. And before we had an elastic spring K here, okay? So the new model is the following one. This elastic spring now has some viscoelastic effect, which means the following thing is that the solid is actually not a rigid solid, okay, but has some, when it moves, is rigid, but when it stays for a while, it displays some kind of liquid effect. So it becomes more smooth, and the elasticity go from the value k to the value k1, which is much smoother, okay? And this allows to introduce a very important ingredient that you have in friction, which is usually called also velocity weakening, which is that if I want to move this table, then I have to impose a force which is much higher if this table is at rest than if it's moving, okay? And so when you have this viscoelasticity, when the solid is at rest, it becomes softer and it can penetrate more in the disorder and landscape. Okay? And so this viscoelasticity, so the presence of this object, which is a damper, acts in this way. The damper, when this block becomes unstable and go in this direction, the damper remains rigid, and so these two springs act like, to be in series, so they act like a big spring of elastic constant K. But then, when you reach this position and is at rest, this damper relax, destroy the elastic, dissipate the elastic energy of the blue spring, and it remains a solid, which is much softer, almost liquid, okay? And so from the point of view of the equation, what I have is what is written here. The first equation is the equation of the depinning plus this term of relaxation, and this is the relaxation term. So you see that you have two viscosity, eta f and eta s. Eta f means is the viscosity compared to the avalanche, so it's something that moves very fast. So when the velocity is positive here, the avalanche moves very fast. This is very large, so it moves very slowly, okay? And when it is at rest, this term goes to zero. So in the fully relaxed situation, when all the aftershocks that I will show in a second have acted, this term disappears, and this is the elastic depinning for a solid which is very soft with an elastic constant K1. But in the moving phase, this solid behaves like a rigid solid with an elastic constant equal to K. Okay?
So what is the sign?
No, why it should be opposite. No, they are like this. Right, the equation. So,
the two equations with the same term.
Yes.
With the same sign.
With the same sign, yes.
So, you want.
So, it should be action and
control. A couple of things, just action, action.
No, maybe depends.
No, but the same sign, it's the opposite sign in the sense of one couples plus H.
Yeah.
And the other one's minus H, do you see? Sorry. Minus U. One is H minus U, one.
Ah, yes, if you do H minus U is the. So U is U that change sign.
So it is minor.
Okay. But I can re-derive you this equation, but it takes a while, because actually UI is not exactly this position, but is a Laplacian related to this position, so it's not so easy to derive this equation. It takes half a page, okay? And but these are the equation of motion, but if you are happy just with the image, this is what happens, okay? So the idea is that I repeat in terms of the stress, when your stress reaches the threshold, okay, then it behaves like before. So you lose stress, you have a stress drop, which is 2Kz, okay, if you sum the green and the blue. Okay, it's exactly like before, and then you have a stress redistribution exactly like before, as if it was a rigid solid. But then this blue part is dissipated, okay, and so disappear with time if nothing moves. And this is the main mechanism of the new model. Okay.
Should we think about UI as the stress then? Can we do that? Or?
UI is a dimension like a stress with some constant k, yes. It's actually the Laplacian of the position which you have here.
Yeah. Okay.
I guess I'm having, in terms of how this relates to friction, I'm having a little problem, because this seems to be somehow increasing the stress transfer, as opposed to having a local force that's different. And you could have achieved it, I think, in Karen's model. What's done is to effectively decrease the lower the pinning field,
yes,
the stress at that point by a larger amount, as opposed to by changing the stiffness. So
yes.
Can you argue why this is a better representation,
yes,
of the actual
local
friction?
We can do this also. Actually, the first models of the Eduardo was to arrange, to relax the pinning threshold. This is what I think you want to say.
Yeah.
The reason, so the phenomenology is very similar, and I will show in a second. The thing is that this model is simpler to solve. So I know how to solve a little bit better this model, and I don't know how to solve the model with the pinning.
Why are you
numerically, for sure, because here we have a local relaxation that can be solved very efficiently. We can write the model from a continuum equation point of view, and I don't know how to solve it. I can do the cellular automata, but I'm not able to write the equation of motion of the elastic interface, viscoelastic interface, with the pinning relaxation. And then the other thing is that I have a technique in my field that is semi-analytic, so that allows to have some better understanding of what's happening, and so is what I did with this model and not with the model of the relaxation of the disorder.
I know that you can, when you have the weakening of thresholds, you can solve for the scaling behavior, but maybe just tell us what you got.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. So let me just show that what you said at the beginning can seem strange, but actually is a mechanism for the aftershocks, okay? So you have these sides which become unstable, okay? So you have a stress drop which is very large, okay, because of this problem of the because you have a elastic constant which is capital K, and then you draw another time the threshold, okay? And so this threshold can be in the blue region, and then because so the system now is stable for a while, but in a time which depends, is stable for a while, but in a time which depends on the time of the relaxation of this dashpot, this side will trigger a new avalanche, which is an aftershock. So this new avalanche, you will have it also if you stop to drive the system. It's just because of the existence of the aftershock, of the dashpots, okay? So it's a model for the aftershock. And actually, if we take some parameters which are not very strange, so if you take the viscoelastic destroy half of the elasticity of the solid, okay, then this is what you get. So these are the avalanches for the elastic solid, and these are the avalanches for the viscoelastic solid. And so what you see here is that you have a lot of, you have a big structure, and you have a lot of aftershocks, okay?
But there's a typical time scale associated with this data.
Yes, so this is a good point. So if you, then I answer. So if you want to reproduce the Moore law, you cannot have a typical time scale, okay? You can change the viscoelasticity, take a Laplacian viscoelasticity instead of this UI, you replace with Laplacian of UI, and then you will have something very similar to the Moore law. But you will lose the fact that you can work a little. So this is simpler, and so we have studied this model, okay? But it's true that for the Moore law, it will be better to introduce a more complicated form of relaxation. Yes. So it's the viscoelastic model where you destroy half of, you destroy in the sense that your solid and elasticity K, half of that will be, this K1 is half of K. Okay? So it means that when you are relaxed, the solid is as half of the elastic constant as before. You see? You have to change here and here, because here we have a characteristic case when the relaxation happens, okay, which is determined by eta s, okay? Is a characteristic time scale, okay? So what I said here. And so after these time scales, then you do not have any effect anymore. So in order to have the Moore law effect, then you have to introduce, for example, a Laplacian relaxation here, which corresponds to a slightly different mechanism. Okay? But then it's more difficult. It's not non-interesting, but more difficult. Yes. Okay? So when you have this kind of picture, then you have to distinguish usually between events and cluster of events. So you can analyze the statistics of each earthquake, or you can analyze the statistic of the main shock plus all the aftershocks and see what happens. So usually people look more to the events because they are easy to distinguish, because for the aftershock it's difficult to decide if an earthquake is an aftershock or is a new main shock. But in our model it's simple because we can split the time scale. So we take the scale of the avalanches as very fast, as zero time, the scale of the aftershock as time one, and the scale of the driving as infinite. So we are sure that all of these are the aftershock of a main shock, okay? So we first analyze the events, and this is what we found. We found that the exponent of the avalanches for the elastic model is smaller than 1.5, it's 1.27 as it is known from the DPM transition. But now if you look at the viscoelastic model, then you find an exponent which is bigger than 1.5 and which is 1.75. So you have this effect that I said at the beginning. The traditional model cannot explain an exponent which is bigger than 1.5, but this model can, because actually, if you look at the statistics of the cluster, the exponent is much smaller, okay? What you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Example is which are larger.
Which one?
No. If you drive by the point.
Eh?
Some special drive.
What are you doing about the business of taking the main shock and the aftershocks together? Which version of
this? No, this is without taking, so are the events, okay?
These are all the events?
All the events without making difference between aftershock. I will write that. If you look at the cluster, the exponent is much smaller, okay? So it's more consistent with 1.27. It's for sure smaller than 1.5, okay? This is numerically difficult to say. And so our idea is that actually this 1.7 is due to the fact that you have clusters which are distributed with exponents which are smaller than 1.5. And then you put random size, which are stable at the beginning, but then after a while, they activate and they generate a new aftershock. So you make a fragmentation of the cluster, okay? And so this is the mechanism that gives you an exponent bigger than 1.5.
And
yes?
Verify that on existing data?
So what, so it's difficult because of the problem of the that I told you about the distinction between main shock and aftershock. But if you look at the data and you try to do some with some criterion this distinction, you see that there are two different exponents for aftershocks and for the main shocks. So there is something which is quite absurd, no?
I'm also confused because what you said before was that even you talked about two different models, but the one I think you're talking about is the one where you put a characteristic time scale, and so the Mori law does not have a heavy tail.
Yes. Is this one? Yes.
Okay. So it's got that problem.
Okay. Is this one? Okay. It's okay. So if you look at the events, we found this Gutenberg literary exponent. And then if you now try to understand and characterize what happens when you have a large earthquake, so this is the thing that I will discuss from now, is the following observation. That if you look now at the cluster, okay, and you look at the area where the cluster occurred, okay, and you measure the stress, which, yes?
The cluster for you is
the ensemble of the main shock plus all the offsprings, yeah, all the aftershocks. Okay? Yeah. So you look at the stress before the events, okay, and after the events, okay? So the average over this area, all the stress, okay? And when you have...
How do you identify the offspring as independent, as separate from independent small events?
Because I stop when I see an avalanche, I just stop the driving. So everything that comes out are aftershocks. Okay, and then only when the system is fully relaxed, I re-drive the system. So I'm sure that it is like this. Okay. Okay. And now what you observe is the following thing. Okay. Okay, this, what I plot is the stress before and after this, these events, okay? So before the stress is higher and after is smaller. And here the different colors correspond to different value of the dissipation. So the blue is the less dissipative system, okay? And so when you look at the pinning model without the time scale or at the small clusters that you have in this model, you cannot say that there is a characteristic value of the stress where the system will become unstable. So it's unpredictable. You cannot say, okay, I have this stress, and then for sure there will be an earthquake. Okay?
I'm still confused. Are you plotting sigma B or sigma A? Or
I'm plotting the both, okay? And here you cannot distinguish that. There will be a sigma A and sigma B. But here, where the cluster are larger, you can distinguish them very well. So these are the sigma B and these are the sigma A, okay? So my point is this distinction is not very important for the Edward Wilkinson model, okay? For the pinning model without, and also for small clusters. But when you have these time scales for the large cluster, it appears a gap which is well defined. And then you can say this region has a high stress and will become unstable very soon. This region is here, so I'm sure that there will be no large earthquakes, okay?
So in this is for some particular system size, does that gap remain constant in the limit of infinite system size, or is it a finite size?
No, it's not a finite size effect because, but then you have two things, okay? You have the size of the system. You fix the value K0, and then you increase the size of the system, and then you have a gap, which is well defined. Okay.
In this case. But not case. In the normal dependent model.
In the normal dependent model, you do not have this effect. Okay? So it will go to zero when you take zero goes to zero. Okay? Yes, it goes to a constant. This is what I try to then explain. Yes, it depends on K and K.
Sorry, what
do
you have to make to collapse this gap?
You have to switch off the viscoelasticity.
Which means K1 equals
K.
K.
Yes. K0. No, K, yes, K1 will be K, yes.
And
this K0 is the dissipation you have in the system. So if you remember, maybe I show you because this is simple, is the drive. K0 is this spring, K1 and K are these two, okay? So K is the sum of these two and K1 is this one.
Sigma A is what?
Sigma A is the sum of the external force, so everything which is not the disorder, the sum of this on the region where you have the avalanche. Okay. The sum of the elastic contribution plus the drive. So it's the force acting on the block. Before
so
the avalanche,
the difference between
what?
Yes, you dissipate stress, and the stress drop of the full system, of the full earthquake. Okay, is okay. Okay. So now what we have done is to try to solve this model in the mean field version, okay, to try to understand why we have this gap. Okay? So I will try to explain why we have this gap. And so in the fully connected model, all the blocks are connected to everybody. And so you just replace in the equation, where you have the Laplacian, you have the difference between the mean position of the interface minus the position of the side I. And this is a simplification that allows you to understand better the model. Okay. So now what I will do, I will first discuss the traditional model in the mean field, try to have the results I need to then discuss the viscoelastic model. So the first model we discuss is just without this dashpot, and then in the second step I will introduce the dashpot. Okay, so this is the equation of this model. That is the driving, the elastic force in the mean field version, and the action of this disorder. Okay, so now this is the point. Maybe I will make an assumption to understand the gap. I will not describe the model with the aftershock, but I will put all the threshold equal to one. Okay, so this. Mm-hmm. All the threshold equal to one, and this makes the model easy to solve. Okay. And when you have this, the quantity that you have to look is the stress acting at the site I. But something which is more similar to what Marcus discussed is the distance to instability. So one minus sigma I is how much stress you have to add to a site to the site I to make it unstable. Okay, and then the rules for delta I are very simple. Once delta I is equal to zero, then the site is unstable. We have the stress drop on the site I, so the distance increase of a random quantity, which is controlled by the distance between narrow wells. And you have also a stress redistribution, because you have the stress drop, but then you increase the stress to all the other side, and this stress redistribution is proportional to Kz, and you have your K0z, which is dissipating. Okay? So and now what you're asking is the following thing. For the model of the depinning, you can study the distribution of the delta. Because when you are in the field, you don't need to follow the distribution of all the n side, but it's enough to follow the distribution of a random site, because they are all identical and independent. And so you can write an equation of motion for P of delta when you change the position W of the drive. Okay? So what the idea is the following. You can start from a very out of equilibrium and a very non-stationary solution for the distribution P of delta. Then you let the system evolve with avalanches and driving. And at a certain value of W, you will be in a fixed point that will become independent of P of W. And this fixed point contains a lot of the physics of this problem. Okay? So it's easy to write this equation because actually you have you start from a distribution of P of delta. So this is a distribution for a given, which is arbitrary distribution, okay? And then you make a shift of delta W. So the first thing that it happens is that there is a shift of all the stress, and so this is given by this equation, and you can develop at the first order, and you have this term, okay? But then you have also another thing that can happen. So if you are close to the instability, if you are here, then because of the shift, a fraction of your sides become unstable. And this fraction is given by P0, K0, delta W, and then the stress is redistributed in a random way following the distribution G of Z, okay? So then once you have the stress drop, you have in principle the stress redistribution, so you kick all the other side, but because you kick all the other side, this is absolutely equivalent to another stress shift, and this is the second generation of your avalanche motion. So the first generation writes like this. So the distribution, when you consider the shift of the of W, the stress shift, and the eventually the sides that become unstable and relax, gives something like this. Okay? And if you look the fixed point of this equation, this fixed point will remain the same for all the other steps, because all the other steps will be exactly the same. The only thing we change is this quantity that will become eventually smaller and smaller if your avalanche will become end at some point. Okay? So if you look at the fixed point solution of this equation, you find you put the equation equal to zero, you find an equation like this. And one important thing is that the value of the distribution at the point delta equals zero, which is the unstable point, does not depend on many details of the distribution G, but just is given by the mean value, okay? So the mean distance between the wells, okay? And then you have the full form of the distribution P of delta, and for the exponential case, is given, for example, by an exponential distribution. So this will be the fixed point for the first model without viscoelasticity. And when you have this distribution, you can actually have a lot of properties of your system. The first one is, if you take the average of this distribution, is the total stress that is in the system when you are at the steady state. So we know from the depending transition that we have a critical force. The critical force is the stress which is in the system when there is a perfect equilibrium between the stress that you dissipate and the stress that you inject. And so the form of the critical force is given by this is given by this formula for the exponential case. And an important thing is that for the softer solid, the stress is much higher than for the more solid solid. So it means that you can, when you have an elastic constant, which is capital K, you are able to absorb less stress than for the elastic constant K1. Okay, this is an important point to understand the viscoelastic system. And then there is a discussion that maybe I will make much shorter. So once you have P of delta, provided that you have P0, which is finite, you can prove using an argument which relates this model to the excursion of a Brownian motion, you can prove two things. You can prove that actually the size of avalanches are related to the excursion of a random walk, And so the steps of a random walk that you do staying up some level, for example, the level 0, are distributed with an exponent 3 over 2, which is the persistent exponent of the Brownian motion plus 1. Okay, and so this exponent is actually the 1.5 of the mean field models. Okay? And then the second thing is that because of the dissipation, what the dissipation does is the following. So you have a random walk, and you want to know how long you stay above the origin. But actually, if you add the dissipation, you want to know how long you stay above a slope, which is k0x. Okay? So your average is 0, and you want to say how long you stay above this slope. And this is a problem. So here you cross the slope, and this is the size of your average. Okay? And so for this problem, we know that the large size, the avalanches are cutted, and are cutted with an exponent which is k0 minus 2. Okay. Now, it is interesting to see the following thing, is that all this discussion, and that I have no time to do, depends on the value that you have for your distribution p of delta in 0. Okay. So you have a value which corresponds to, let's say that this is the critical case where k0, you have no dissipation, okay, and this is 1 over capital K. Okay? Now, if you start from a distribution, if you are on a distribution which stays below this point, then you have, it's like to have, so 1 plus K plus K, oh, K plus k0, then you stay below this critical point, and your avalanches are cutted because you have a finite slope which is positive, and the probability that you stay forever above the finite slope is 0. Okay? When, by chance, you are on the critical point, then you have really free scale statistic because k0 is equal to 0. Okay? But if you are above the critical point, you are here, then the slope is actually negative. And so you are asking what is the probability that you stay above a slope which is negative. And then you have a finite probability that you stay above this forever. And this corresponds to have an avalanche that is global in the sense that all sides are involved in the avalanche. Okay? So unfortunately, I have no time to explain the correspondence between the Brownian motion, but it's quite straightforward.
And the critical point is control, so whether I'm below or above is controlled just by k naught?
0, because as you're, if you remember well, I said that p0 does not depend on the distribution, it's just 1 over k plus k naught. So when you are in the fixed point of the dependent transition, k naught is always positive, dissipation usually is always positive. And so you always stay below the critical point and you cut your avalanche. Mm-hmm. If you are in a system which is non-dissipative, then you have a free scale statistics. But for some reason you are above this point, then you
That's
have...
That's what I'm asking is how do I go above that point?
Okay, you do not, it's not the fixed point of the dependent transition, but I will show the mechanism that will drive you in this situation. Okay. So now this is the case for the dependent transition. And now let me explain the viscoelastic simulation. Okay, so now we can evolve P of delta and not evolve the system, but really the equation of P of delta for the infinite system. And I draw here the two fixed points for the dependent transition. So in green you have two functions. The one which is below is the function which corresponds to the solid, very rigid solid, and the one which is above is the one which corresponds to the soft solid. Okay.
Now, viscoelastic one.
Viscoelastic, not the viscoelastic. So the viscoelastic
is between the two.
It's between the two. So the blue is viscoelastic. The two green are the perfect elastic pinning, but with two different constants. This is very rigid, capital K, and this is K1. Okay. And now you let evolve the system, so you both with avalanches and relaxation. And what you observe is that your distribution, because the relaxation at the end, when everything is fully relaxed, and the drag is very slow, corresponds to the relaxation, what is the dream of the relaxation is that you go to the purely the pinning critical state with an elastic constant K1, so to the soft form. So this So and the shape of the function start to change and go to this shape. But then the problem is that when you do avalanches, the rules of the avalanches are the one of the rigid system. And so when your P0 touch this critical point, then your relaxation dynamics become unstable for the avalanches, and you have a huge avalanche that control all the system, and because when all the points move following the rules of the avalanches, they move to the critical point of the depinning, which is rigid, then you move exactly to this critical point. But then, because of the relaxation, you move immediately to another distribution, which is far from this critical point. So you have two fixed points, let's say, and you oscillate between them, and if you look at the average of this distribution, you get the signal of the stress as a function of the driving, and you see that you have period where nothing happens, so nothing moves and the stress increases, and then you have an immediately stressed drop, which is global and of course everywhere in the system. So this is something which is very well known even in a problem. One degree of freedom is the stick slip instability. Here we have a problem with an infinite number of degrees of freedom. We have avalanches here, but they are very, very small compared to the huge avalanche that you have here, which is a global avalanche. And so this is this is the result. If you now use the mean field and you re-put the threshold random, but you just do the Monte Carlo simulation, then what you get is that the global events are still there, but you have also an aftershock structure. Okay? So the only difference between my calculation and the model that I define in mean field is that you miss this aftershock, but you get these global events, and you get this gap, which characterizes the jump between the system before the move and the sigma after the move.
So in mean field, there is no aftershock?
In mean field, you can have aftershocks if you put a random threshold. If you put the threshold equal to 1, and this is how we solve, we do not have aftershocks. You have avalanches, but you do not have aftershocks. Okay? If you are able to solve the model with sigma, which is non 1, then you will have aftershocks.
Can you relate for me? Sorry, go ahead.
So you have smaller avalanches which are building up to the big one? Is that?
Yes.
Yes.
So in this region, you have small avalanches, then you have this one, and you have a lot of aftershocks,
right.
And then you have go up, okay?
How do I relate that drop to the field of delta shifts between the two? That drop is, it's an infinite, so that's the total stress in the system at some point, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, so because here you have a huge avalanche, every time that a site is active, you lose some stress, and so you have a huge stress drop. Okay.
In the mean field, I think you said this earlier. What's the distribution of the? If you only take the aftershocks, what distribution do they have in the mean field?
In the mean field, we didn't look. We look in 2D, okay, and in 2D you have the exponent 173. So most of the shocks are after. Main shock. Sorry, you say aftershock or okay. Aftershock, the exponent is the Gutenberg curve. Why? Is the main shock that have another exponent. Which is difficult to extract, but is more 1.2. So it's similar to the depinning one. But I cannot say that it's the same, okay?
It's higher, you're saying for the main shock, you have you get a higher exponent.
Smaller.
You said
for the aftershock is this one.
it's only aftershock.
No, everything, but if I plot the aftershock, it will be the same. Because they are most of the shocks are aftershocks. So this distribution is totally dominated by the aftershocks. Okay?
And the large shock distribution is pretty narrow. Right?
Yes, yes.
The main shock is
1.0. No, I would like this is like this, but I cannot say for the moment with the numerics. It's for sure smaller than 1.5. Okay. This is for the 2D. So now let me conclude. So this is the new field model, okay? So now the understanding we have is that actually we have a kind of stick slip instability. So when we are stick, then the static friction coefficient in our model, which is due by our rules, is actually much bigger. Not be as big as the soft solid, but so bigger than the dynamic one, and the dynamic one corresponds to the one of the rigid solid. So we have a friction which is higher when we are stick. We have avalanches here, but they are not enough to trigger all the system and to move all the system. But at some point here, you are able to create a large avalanche that trigger all the system and moves all the system, and then it goes down. We lose stress up to the dynamic friction coefficient, which is exactly the one of the solid depinning. And then we still have the stick phase. Okay?
This is only mean field, or it also happens?
Mean field. So I'm finishing with mean field. So just to give a motivation, this periodic oscillation of stress were actually observed quite recently in a model which is similar with the one I've studied, where the relaxation was in the pinning. For example, I know this one is a nature by Setna, Papanicolaou, Zapier, and so on. And so they do not are in mean field, but they have a very, very long range interactions. Okay, and they compare their simulation where they observe quasi periodic pulses with this experiment of microcrystals, where they measure the slips after the compression. And most of the time, the slips are of these values. So these are the normal avalanches. But then, quasi periodically, you have big bursts, which are interpreted as global events. Okay? In our model, they appear in mean field. And now I want to say what happens in finite dimension to conclude. So now, in finite dimension, we do not see global events. Okay? But if we look in two regions of the space and we measure the stress in these two regions, we see this oscillatory behavior, and this gap is exactly the gap I showed you before when I started to say now I want to explain this gap. This is the gap we see, and as you see, it's not very different from the red region and the blue region. So the green signal here is the whole system, so there is a kind of characteristic size of this global oscillation. Above this, they do not talk each other, they have the same period and the same jump, but the phase is different. And so our observation is that this mechanism that appears in mean field, and which is on the entire system, it appears on lower dimension on a local scale that is not still very well characterized, but explain the gap observed in this figure. To be clear, let me show the figure. This one. Okay? This is exactly the same gap.
Is this
K0
or is it not related to
K0? It is related to K0, but is a finite limit when K0. Ah, no, the scale. The scale is related to K0, and this is the thing we are trying to characterize. It grows with K0, but we cannot tell you if it diverges when K0 is equal to 0 or not. So, the system are quite big, are 100,000 sites, but it's not easy to see. The special scale, it means how big is this patch where you have this oscillation. Okay? And so, to conclude, there was a movie that it was not able to extract, but so the movie was the following. So this is a map of the stress in our interface. So the green and yellow region corresponds to the very high stress, the blue region corresponds to the very low stress, and this is something that you have in this viscoelastic model that you will not have in the standard FDTD model. You have region where you can say that where there is yellow and red, it is very likely that you will have a bigger earthquake. And so in the movie that I cannot show is that the earthquake starts here, so this will be the main shock. And then an interesting feature of our aftershock, which is consistent with the idea of fragmentation that I explained to you before, is that there is an integration effect of the aftershock. So this is the first region that goes down, and then the aftershock increase. They are not totally inside the region of the earthquake, but increase the surface of the earthquake. And this, unfortunately, I cannot show you in the movie, but you see that during the relaxation, this size becomes larger and larger. Okay. So to conclude, I present a viscoelastic interface which has a rich dynamics with main shocks and aftershocks. In two dimensions, our results are consistent with the big Gutenberg-Richter exponent and displays both spatial correlation and a periodic behavior on a local scale. So in a given region, you expect to have a periodic behavior. In mean field, this periodicity is understood as a global periodicity and a stick-slip behavior of the entire system. Okay, thank you very much.
So maybe we should talk more about it tomorrow at the discussion tomorrow, but one of the things that's always struck me as strange about the Gutenberg-Richter is that the same exponent seems to apply for earthquakes that are small enough that they're effectively two-dimensional, that is, their depth is less than the 10 kilometers or whatever of the crustal region, and also for things that are larger than that and things which involve perhaps many, many fault planes. And so if you were to try to look at a single fault which was very narrow in one dimension and long, which would be, say, a better model of the San Andreas fault, it's not obvious that this model would still give you the same exponent as Gutenberg-Richter, or whether or not it
yes.
should. And I don't know if we have any real earthquake people here that can help us tomorrow, but there's also, from what I've seen, the arguments about why what this exponent is are for the earthquake models are pretty pretty poor. I mean, there's an energy that's inferred.
I am not an earthquake expert. I might have been 25 years ago, but I'm certainly not now. My impression is that the statistical interpretation it depends very much on whether you how you deal with it. If you look at single faults, what you see is the Gutenberg-Richter-like distribution and then a distribution of big events. It looks quite solid. If you start averaging over many different faults, you see different things. I think so far as I remember, that is still in a state of flux. There's no really definitive statistical analysis of these things, but I hope I'm completely wrong, and we ought to get Rafa Chaletta over here.
But all of that also is in terms of moments, not in terms of energy, and so it's conversion of energy to moments.
What they call a moment, the seismic moment, and the energy release.
That's probably
okay, I think, but I'm not sure. One other point I might just make here, you showed this, what I imagine is a movie which is entirely based on your simulation.
Yes.
But that, I think, the seismologists have, in fact, started to make pictures of, because they have all these wonderful physics techniques for inferring from satellite measurements and stuff like that. And I think I've seen pictures that are sort of like, okay, you look at one big earthquake and then you plot and see where the aftershocks are as a function of time.
I think Eugenio has seen the data more than me for sure.
Yeah, yeah, the question of the so-called characteristic earthquake is not solved yet, so you have less statistics to say. So just to define what is a single fault is a very complicated issue. So to separate events only localized on a single fault is just for it by itself, a very complicated definition.
Yes.
And then looking at the statistics, you have the problem that big shocks are very huge. So the question, say, they are characteristics, they are fluctuations or not, so it's hard to be settled down question.
But the energy to moment is what I'm particularly concerned about. I've seen differences in the estimate of how that translates that are 0.2 certainly. And there's a question of whether the scaling between moment and energy is the same for small earthquakes and large earthquakes. And
yes, it depends on if you consider a two-dimensional system, so it comes to account. So this is another problem.
So maybe we can postpone this discussion to a discussion tomorrow. There are certainly questions to an advanced director.
This is a technical question.
Okay, so the background, so I didn't explain this because I have no time. So in the standard model, in the model without viscoelasticity, there is no backward motion because you can prove it. Here there is backward motion. It will correspond to put another threshold below, which corresponds to the fact that if you are pushing this direction, you want to move back. Okay? Now, because you work at the stress which is quite high, so the sigma k or sigma k plus 1, sigma k 1, then the probability to have this backward motion is very small. So we have run the simulation with or without this rule, and for a given disorder, you see more or less the same dynamics, not after averaging. I mean, you really see that the line is really moving more or less. This is very rare.
They could be moving without backward motion, which are the same.
Yes, so in principle, it's just that if you do not, if you say that this threshold is minus infinity, there is no backward motion. So in view, at the end, we impose that, and the results are presented are like this because it's more efficient. But we have checked on smaller system that this was a good approximation.
So I wanted to get a little more feeling for the spatial map of the large shocks and the aftershock. So what in the viscoelastic models sets those scales, if there are spatial scales in there?
This is the intriguing question. So what you mean is, what is the scale of these large clusters? So this is the point that we are trying to understand. So it's for sure K0 playing an important role, the dissipation playing an important role, as for the standard deepening. But we still...
But in the standard deepening, without the viscoelasticity, you don't get these structures, right? Or you don't get
You have just one avalanche here, and then one avalanche here, and you do not have this terrace structure. Okay? It's very homogeneous, it's very noisy and
But if you have all those statistics of this measure, then probably you are not characteristic scale.
Right,
yes.
So
it depends on the time you have.
But
it
if I look at that distribution, it might be a parallel, but then what could help? Just
should be a connection between the sides of the scale and the sides of the measure. So probably you have all those statistics of this scale, so probably you have all scales that are involved.
An important point that maybe to respond more precisely also to Pierre, when I said that we don't know if it diverges at K0, for sure it diverges when K0 goes down. What we are not able to see now is if it diverges at the finite K0 or at 0 K0.
Yeah, quick question. On Monday we saw these nice, all these other statistical measures, for example, like how the number of aftershocks relates to the size of the main shock. Have you looked at any of those?
No, I haven't. Yes, I also noticed that. I want to believe. I didn't know that there was this low productivity low in men.
Yeah.
Yes, I did.
And that was made a point about the long-range model, because we expect elasticity dominating this kind of problem. And so all the features you presented as qualitatively will remain, the exponent larger than 3R. You expect, or you have no clue?
Okay, so concerning we have an infinite solution which is very long range, so this stress oscillation are observed also in midfield, so we expect it to be also with long range interaction. But my point on the Gutenberg-Richter law is the following, is that if you take clusters and you say that you have like traditional avalanches of long range line or long range interfaces, and then you say that parts of a fraction of the size that belong to this avalanche are quiet for a while, so they seem to be inactive and then become inactive later, then you have a fragmentation, and when you have a fragmentation, the exponent grows. So this is just a generic end-waving mechanism to explain why it can be bigger than 1.5, even if the depending is smaller than 1.5.
There are no more questions. Let's thank Adele.